The House votes today on a bill to extend health care subsidies for 3 years, a vote Republican leaders did not want to happen. We'll hear from two congressmen on their bipartisan plan. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. When is law enforcement allowed to use lethal force? That's the question after an ICE officer killed a woman in Minneapolis. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Officers cannot shoot someone just for driving away, and police conduct before the shooting matters too. Also, the Trump administration says it will manage Venezuela's oil sales indefinitely. It's also seizing more tankers connected to Venezuela's oil industry. It is Thursday, January 8th. On this day in 1867, Congress overrode President Andrew Johnson's veto of a bill giving black men in Washington, D.C. the right to vote. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal and local officials in Minnesota dispute why an ICE officer shot and killed a woman yesterday in Minneapolis. The Trump administration says the agent acted in self-defense. Videos reviewed by NPR show a different officer demanding the motorist get out of the car and then grabbing the door handle. The SUV reverses, then goes forward. The ICE agent near the front of the vehicle fires into the car and then backs away. The car drives forward and then crashes. Hundreds of people gathered in South Minneapolis last night to mourn the woman who was killed, Renee Nicole Good. From Minnesota Public Radio, Erica Zurich reports.
The crowd stretched several blocks on Portland Avenue and chanted in unison. The mood was somber and emotions were on display as speakers demanded justice and the prosecution of the agent responsible for shooting Good. Simia Osman lives in Minneapolis. She says she's feeling numb and disgusted.
We're being targeted, and this is not acceptable. An innocent woman, Renee Nicole Good, just got killed for no reason. I want her to rest in peace, and I want our city and our nation to wake up.
Those gathered at the vigil say they'll keep showing up to support the family of Renee Nicole Good and all their neighbors who are being taken off the street by ICE. For NPR News, I'm Erica Zurich in Minneapolis.
Police in Salt Lake City say there's been a deadly shooting in the parking lot of a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints building. Police Department spokesman Glenn Mills says a funeral was underway inside the Mormon Church building when a dispute escalated outside into gunfire.
We know that there are at least 8 victims. I can confirm that 2 of them have died. 3 of them are in critical condition, and 3 others are in unknown condition.
Salt Lake City police say no one is in custody. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has briefed Congress on the U.S. military operation in Venezuela. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports lawmakers showed a partisan divide on the information as they left the briefing.
Rubio says he told Congress step one will involve quarantine for Venezuela, which will include selling sanctioned oil and distributing the profits. Step two, recovery, will restore access to the Venezuelan market in a way he described as fair. He did not offer details on how step three, transition, will work. Lawmakers have been clamoring for a briefing from the administration, which did not notify Congress until after the military operation concluded. Republican lawmakers left the briefing praising the operation, while Democrats criticized the administration for not being forthright about what these next steps will entail. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called on the administration to answer questions in public hearings. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is NPR. The Trump administration is withdrawing and cutting funding from 66 international organizations. Many of them are UN agencies and private groups focused on migration, Mideast peace, and climate change. Secretary of State Rubio is condemning programs, including those he calls climate orthodoxy. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced new dietary guidelines for Americans. These are focused on promoting whole foods, healthy proteins, and fats. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the administration has unveiled a new food pyramid with red meat, vegetables, and fruits pictured at the top.
Secretary Kennedy described the new guidelines as the most significant reset on nutrition policy in history, calling for an end to policies that promote highly refined foods that are harmful to health. The guidelines will set limits on added sugars and encourage diets that include meat and dairy.
Protein and healthy fats are essential, and were wrongly discouraged in prior dietary guidelines. We are ending the war on saturated fats.
The guidelines are highly influential, determining what's served in school meals and on military bases, as well as what's included in federal food aid. Alice Naubry, NPR News.
In Los Angeles yesterday, Nick Reiner was not formally charged with killing his parents, Hollywood director Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle. Nick Reiner never entered a plea. That's because his lawyer has withdrawn from his case but did not explain why. Nick Reiner will now be represented by a public defender. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The story would always go that Lonnie Anderson owed her career to a red swimsuit. The former Miss Roseville, Minnesota, had been knocking on doors in Hollywood for 3 years. Not really that long in the scheme of things, but she was almost 33 and still doing bit parts in TV shows. A far cry from her days at Minnesota's Chanhassen Dinner Theater, where she played the eldest daughter and Fiddler on the Roof for 53 weeks. Now that was steady work. But then in 1978, the creator of a new TV show saw a picture of Lonnie in a red swimsuit. That got his attention, and her an audition and an offer to play a blonde, voluptuous, and to her mind, totally boring receptionist. Still, what actress would turn down a regular gig? But she did. Unless, that is, her blonde bombshell character could also be the smartest person in the room.
Morning, Herb.
And that was how Lonnie Anderson turned what could have been a throwaway part into the breakout role of Jennifer Marlowe, the sexy and savvy receptionist at a struggling radio station in the sitcom WKRP in Cincinnati.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The House of Representatives will vote today on a measure that would extend enhanced health insurance subsidies that expired at the end of the year. In a few minutes, we'll hear from two members of Congress, one Republican, one Democrat, who've been working together to make that happen.
Today's vote comes after weeks of disagreement within the Republican caucus about how to address health care costs. And it'll take place against the wishes of House Speaker Mike Johnson. Joining us now to tell us more about this is NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass. Sam, good morning.
Hey, Michelle.
So let's begin with the action in the House today. Remind us of the backstory on how this vote is taking place. It's actually pretty dramatic.
Yeah, Republican leadership for weeks refused to allow a vote on extending the subsidies. Then just before the holiday recess, four swing district Republicans joined with Democrats to force a vote on extending the subsidies for 3 years, going around leadership using a maneuver called a discharge petition. And yesterday, a procedural motion to set up that vote today got support from nine Republicans.
So it sounds like Speaker Johnson is starting off the year with another challenge to his leadership. Does he see it that way?
Well, this is not the first time a handful of Republicans have worked with Democrats to circumvent the speaker. Last year, enough Republicans also forced a vote to release the Epstein files. Another discharge petition forced a vote on overturning President Trump's order prohibiting collective bargaining for many federal employees. Here's Johnson back in December addressing efforts to force these votes.
This is not a challenge to the speaker's leadership. Here's the reality, everybody. We have a razor-thin majority, a record small majority.
True, but past Republican speakers have also had, you know, that challenge. Is this any different?
I put that question to GOP strategist Mike Ricci. He worked for two former Republican speakers, John Boehner and Paul Ryan.
If members don't trust the speaker, they don't feel like the speaker has their back, there's no question this is a direct referendum on the speaker himself.
Okay, so this discharge petition is likely to pass the House today. What happens after that? Do you think it's going to become law?
Probably not. Even its backers in the House acknowledge a three-year extension is very unlikely to pass the Senate, which already voted down a similar measure last month. The hope, though, is that success in the House recharges talks across the Capitol in the Senate. And there are signs that may actually be happening. A small bipartisan group of senators have been negotiating this week, and several of them told reporters they're getting close to a deal. I asked one of those senators, Republican Bernie Moreno of Ohio, how he would characterize it.
So we're in the red zone, but that does not mean a touchdown. It could mean a 95-yard fumble.
And one potential sticking point is that some Republicans want more stringent language around ensuring federal money is not used for abortion. President Trump earlier this week said Republicans may need to be a little flexible. Moreno says he's not worried about reaching consensus on this.
And before we let you know, how much do we know about what's going to be in the deal?
Moreno says the emerging deal would be a two-year extension, and in the second year, patients could choose to have funds deposited in a health savings account instead of those subsidies going to an insurance company. This is something President Trump has been pushing for. The plan would also include an income cap and other changes Republicans want, and open enrollment would likely be extended so people who drop coverage could still sign up. But there are many Republicans deeply opposed to the subsidies, so it is really not clear what the ultimate fate of a compromise bill would even be.
That is NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass. Sam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Now that the ACA tax credits have expired, some members of Congress are warning about the effect it'll have on Americans.
For the people that are receiving these subsidies, for those subsidies to go away, it's a huge deal for them.
That's Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. He's one of the swing district Republicans Sam just told us about. Fitzpatrick is also part of a bipartisan group in the House called the Problem Solvers Caucus.
Fitzpatrick co-chairs the group with Tom Suozzi, a Democrat from New York.
This is going to be a body blow to people throughout the country that are now getting these premium tax credits.
Suozzi and Fitzpatrick are behind the discharge petition that's made today's vote on extending the subsidies possible. They sat down together in Suozzi's office to talk to our co-host, A. Martinez, about the road ahead.
The bill that we're voting on is to put it back the way it was before for 3 years, but that's unlikely to become the final law. Brian can speak for himself, but he didn't support the idea of a clean 3-year extension. But he did this because he knew we had to get it to the Senate. The Senate will then negotiate to try and come up with a bipartisan compromise, we hope, on their side, and then bring it back to us again.
So, Congressman Fitzpatrick, how did you square those two ideas, not being in favor of a clean 3 years, but also knowing, for you at least, that you wanted this something to be there for your constituents?
Yeah, because there was only one thing that was worse than a clean extension with no income caps and no reforms, and that would be complete expiration with no bridge, no off-ramp for people who need these subsidies. Myself and Tom and so many of our colleagues, both Democrat and Republican, offered multiple two-party solutions, multiple different iterations that in large part did the same thing. It enacted reforms, anti-fraud measures, income caps to ensure that the lower and middle-income earners were benefiting the most from these subsidies. All of those options were rejected, unfortunately, by House leadership, so it left us with two options, either expiration or clean extension. And clean extension is a far better option, in my view, and that's why I proceeded down the path that I did.
How many other of your Republican colleagues do you think would support that?
Well, there were only room for 4 signatures, and we got 4 signatures almost instantly after I led the charge to sign. There were many others that were ready to sign, but once it hits 218, the petition is closed. So, you know, the final number remains to be seen. And keep in mind, that this is a vehicle that will go to the Senate. The Senate will then put their stamp on it. It will, in all likelihood, emerge back to the House as something close to the proposal that Tom and I worked on, along with our other colleagues, that have those reforms and income caps that I mentioned.
Congressman Suozzi, if indeed this bill passes, I mean, will this ultimately be vindication, you think, for your party's decision to make healthcare such an important issue in last year's government shutdown?
Well, I think it's a victory for the American people and the people that we serve, both parties, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, they all care about this issue. And, you know, Brian and I serve as the co-chairs of a group called the Problem Solvers Caucus. And it's about 50 members of Congress, pretty evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. And every problem we face in our country, including this one, is complicated. And you can't solve complicated problems with everybody just yelling and screaming at each other and saying, you're one of those. No, you're one of those. You need people of goodwill who may disagree with each other, like Brian do and I do. We disagree on a lot of stuff. But we work together to say, hey, let's try and find common ground.
But Congressman Swazi, we live in a world where we look at the scoreboard after everything that happens, no matter what. We want to see who wins and who loses. Will it be perceived as a win for Democrats if this happens?
Yeah, it will be. And it'll be seen as a victory also for the people who want to promote bipartisanship, because the Democrats couldn't do this on their own.
Congressman Fitzpatrick, even if this bill does pass in the House, it would need, of course, to pass in the Senate before President Trump would have to make that decision to sign it or not. What kind of support do you think this would need to get in the House for Majority Leader John Thune to actually allow a vote in the Senate?
Well, I think it's going to be taken up regardless, you know, because getting the vehicle to the Senate was the key. I am very confident in the signals that we see coming out of the Senate. After we got 218 on this discharge, it completely breathed life into this issue in the Senate. It was all but dead. And I'm confident that they're going to get something done and get something back to us.
Are you worried at all over the kind of pressure all of this might put on President Trump? If he's got this on his desk waiting to make a decision, and it seems like it has support both in the Senate and in the House, wouldn't that put a lot of pressure on President Trump to actually sign it?
Well, I think it tells him that it's the will of the people. It shouldn't be pressure. It should be an easy signature. And I believe he will sign it.
Congressman Swazi, what about you? What do you think?
I think there's no question about it. The president, if you know, for all the things I don't like about him, he follows the polls and he follows what the people are asking for. And the people are asking for us to address this health care affordability issue.
If all this gets to the finish line and the subsidies are extended for 3 more years, do you think that is enough time to come up with a solution or maybe a different way forward for healthcare in the United States? Congressman Swazi, let's start with you on that.
Healthcare, even if we get these subsidies put back in place, these tax credits put back in place, is way too expensive. We spend way too much money at the end of people's lives. We don't spend enough money on prevention. We know the leading causes of early death, avoidable deaths, are smoking, improper diet, and lack of exercise. And we have to do more with preventative, making sure people get their primary care early, as opposed to waiting till they're very, very sick. And we have seen during this process that there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that really want to get something done. And this is an opportunity for us to show that we can work together with, like we have here, and we can do even more things together if we get a little bit of a breather and we're not under the gun like this.
What about you, Congressman Fitzpatrick?
Yeah, I think this is a case with a lot of these issues, and healthcare certainly included, that for too long, too many have allowed the perfect to be the enemy of the good. I think, A, that we need to get back to the basics with healthcare. I represent Levittown, Pennsylvania. Tom here represents Levittown, New York. And when I grew up in Levittown, doctors, by and large, worked out of their own houses. There was very little between the doctor-patient relationship. And you look at the healthcare system today, where doctors then started working for hospitals, and then the hospitals were working for insurance companies, and then the insurance companies were working for hedge funds. And there's been massive vertical integration that has been incredibly harmful to the healthcare delivery system, incredibly harmful to patients. So I think we just need to get back to the basics in healthcare. And to your question, do we have enough time to do it? Of course we do. We know what needs to be done. The question is, are there enough people with courage, with backbone in both parties to cross the aisle to actually get it done? And that's a question that remains to be seen. You know the answer when it comes to Tom and I. We do it every single day. It's built into our genetic DNA. That's how we operate.
That's Tom Swazi, a Democrat from New York, and Brian Fitzpatrick, a Republican from Pennsylvania. They're the co-chairs of the Problem Solvers Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
In today's world of on-demand media streaming over the internet, one has to wonder, why does traditional radio still matter? I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXE. Why do we work so hard to offer traditional broadcasting when people can just jump on the internet and get instant access? Well, here's why. KAXE is available to everyone in our listening area, no matter your financial or social status. Anyone with a radio can hear KAXE, and you get the same great experience whether you're a member, a business sponsor, or just hearing about us for the first time. We do stream on our website, but it doesn't take a costly internet connection to hear KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. We serve the whole community, and we can't do that without you. Tell others about us, or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. KAXE is an equalizer, making great content available to you no matter who you are. KAXE is people-powered radio.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Officials and many residents in Minnesota are angry and upset after an immigration officer shot and killed Renee Nicole Good in her car on Wednesday. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said he feared something like this would happen after the Trump administration ramped up immigration enforcement. The Trump administration says the agent was defending himself. Now, many people have questions about this incident, but NPR's law enforcement correspondent Martin Costi is going to focus on what the law says about when officers can shoot at a moving car. And let me warn you, you're going to hear the sound of gunfire.
The bystander videos show the final moments as agents get out of a pickup and approach a maroon SUV that's crosswise in the street, blocking their way. One agent grabs the door handle. The SUV backs up, then turns away from the Fed's truck. And that's when another officer, standing just off the driver's side fender, opens fire at the driver.
No! No! Shit!
The driver was pronounced dead at a local hospital. The federal government's version of what happened was laid out later in the day by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who called the shooting preventable. She said the woman had been, quote, harassing immigration agents, something she says has been happening to them a lot. Noem said the driver of the SUV had been, quote, stalking and impeding their work, unquote, and agents ordered her to get out.
She then proceeded to weaponize her vehicle, and she attempted to run an law enforcement officer over. This appears as an attempt to kill or to cause bodily harm to agents.
Noem's choice of words matters. Over the decades, the courts have said that officers can't shoot someone just for trying to drive away. They need to have a reasonable perception of an imminent threat of death or great bodily harm to them or someone else before they may shoot at a driver. And in the Minneapolis case, that's very much in doubt. Many people who've looked at the video see a driver who's just trying to drive away. The mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, dismissed the Fed's version of events.
Having seen the video of myself, I want to tell everybody directly, that is This was an agent recklessly using power that resulted in somebody dying, getting killed.
And the question isn't just whether the officer was reasonable in feeling threatened. Seth Stoughton is a former cop, now a law professor at the University of South Carolina, where he specializes in the study of tactics and the use of force. He says the officer's actions leading up to the shooting also matter.
There are articles in Police Magazine from 20 years ago that describe stepping into a vehicle's path of travel as a very poor tactic. An ill-advised tactic, a tactic that is contrary to common sense. Officers shouldn't be in a position where a vehicle can actually hit them.
Stoughton is not passing judgment on this incident, but he says in theory, local law enforcement could bring charges against the federal officer. Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is investigating, as is the FBI. Martin Costi, NPR News.
Millions of Americans are expected to lose federal food benefits in the next few years as states implement new Republican requirements for SNAP. But for many who need this food, hunger is not political, it's visceral, and the health effects can last for years. Karen Brown of New England Public Media reports.
How many items did you say?
Three.
Okay.
Marilyn Vargas is pushing a grocery cart at a food bank in East Hampton, Massachusetts.
So I have a pack of breast chicken, cookies, Cheerios.
Her household of six needs this food. She says their only income is her disability check, and when the federal government delayed November's SNAP benefits during the shutdown.
Yes, I was very worried, because I don't get enough money.
Fresh in her mind is the time before she moved to this area, when she couldn't afford any food because transportation to her job fell through.
I felt terrible. I was crying. I was desperate. The only thing food I had, I gave it to my kids.
This is what hunger looks like in the U.S., says Mariana Chilton, a UMass Amherst public health professor. It's not the stereotype that many people imagine.
They think, oh, there couldn't possibly be hunger in America, because the way that we know that that exists is because children have distended bellies and flies in their eyes or look visibly malnourished.
In reality, Chilton says, hunger can show up in many ways, like school kids' behavior.
They can't focus. They may be more likely to get in fights with their peers or not be able to listen.
In babies, she says, even short-term hunger can affect the brain. They're growing hundreds of neurons a second and need fuel to interact with the world.
Even just 1 or 2 days of reduced intake is going to affect their cognitive, social, and emotional development.
Mary Cowie is a retired teacher in Western Massachusetts. She can attest to the lasting scars of hunger. Cowie grew up on Long Island in a family of 10 with only her father's salary as a teacher. She says they survived largely on potatoes and surplus shark given to them by a local fisherman.
And we were glad to have the shark and potatoes because there were some times when we didn't have the shark and potatoes.
She remembers the pain of an empty belly, jealousy over classmates' lunches, and competing for food at the table.
It was not uncommon for my sister to like reach over and take something off my plate. So we learned to eat really fast.
Only the youngest siblings got milk, and Cowie remembers getting her first school physical in fourth grade.
And I remember the nurse letting me read the scale, you know, when you'd push the thing across, and it was 40 pounds.
She was 9. Cowie is now 65. After a series of broken bones, she was diagnosed with severe osteoporosis. She blames an early lack of calcium. Her bones are so brittle, her doctor says another fall could disable her. And even though she hasn't gone without food in decades, Cowie still describes herself as an opportunistic eater. When she sees food, she eats it.
There's this mentality of like, in case there's not food tomorrow. For me, that never went away.
Conservative politicians often claim fraud in the SNAP program as a reason to limit benefits. Marilyn Vargas, leaving the food bank with a full cart, has another theory.
I don't think they've ever been hungry, exactly. Especially Trump, he's never been hungry because his father was rich.
In 2023, 13% of American households were considered food insecure by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There is no public data after that because the Trump administration has canceled the annual survey. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Western Massachusetts.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with New England Public Media and KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
Filmmaker Shireen Dibas was about to begin shooting a movie about generational trauma among Palestinians when the war in Gaza began.
You know, some days we were shooting scenes that we were watching come across our news feeds, things that were happening in Gaza.
I'm Juana Summers, the new film, All That's Left of You, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXC. Good morning. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton. Let's take a look at what our weather is looking like for our day today. We are seeing some possible fog this morning. Could be some freezing fog, not frogs, as far as I know, they are frozen. But that could lead to some slippery roads and some poor visibility. Then becoming mostly cloudy, highs 30 to 35, southwest winds 5 to 10, becoming north with overnight temperatures tonight anywhere from 6 to 18 degrees, and that's above zero. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, Friday, to partly sunny with a slight chance of snow. Highs 25 to 30 degrees. Coming up next is our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. Also coming up later today, the Season Watch podcast will be published. You can sign up for it through Apple or Spotify or the podcast platforms that you use. Comes out on Thursdays, and you get a mix of student reports, or this week a teacher from Little Falls, as well as John Latimer. Support this morning comes from Rural Pathways, helping rural nonprofits and communities find funding, measure impact, strengthen strategy, and plan for the future. More information available on Facebook and at ruralpathways.org. Rural Pathways, bold solutions for quiet places.
On today's date, January 8th, in the year 2001, great horned owls are heard calling. This is just the beginning of their season. They will call back and forth, male to female, the female having slightly higher voice than the male. And this calling will go on for most of the month as they set up a pattern for housekeeping. Whether or not they actually nest in the area remains to be seen. They are a territorial bird, and because of their ferocious nature, any other bird would be well advised to not encroach on the territories of the great horned owls. Their calling and their courtship will result in nesting, which will begin in February, and their offspring will be born with a remarkably thick coat of down and will survive the cold temperatures thanks to the expert and attentive actions of their parents.
So I would say our entire region is heavily impacted by federal sector actions.
According to BLS data, Virginia's unemployment rate has been relatively steady at 3.5%, while Maryland's has climbed to 4.2%. The Fuller Institute estimates regional federal job losses between D.C., Maryland, and Virginia at about 41,000 jobs. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Abamu in Bethesda.
Wall Street futures are lower this morning. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Jitasa, providing bookkeeping, accounting, and CFO services exclusively to the nonprofit sector. Jitasa is committed to serving nonprofits who make the world a better place. JITASA.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at Lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. U.S. forces boarded an oil tanker they had been pursuing for nearly 2 weeks across the Atlantic.
Yeah, during the chase, the tanker changed its name and even began flying a Russian flag. All of this comes as the Trump administration begins releasing new details about their plans for Venezuela's oil industry.
NPR's Greg Myrie has the details. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, Michelle.
So this boat was somewhere between Britain and Iceland. How did it get there?
It was quite the adventure. U.S. ships in the Caribbean have been targeting sanctioned oil tankers, these ghost ships, for the past month. They homed in on one in late December. It was called the Bella One and believed to be heading to Venezuela to pick up oil. But the Bella One refused to halt. Instead, it changed course and headed out to the Atlantic with U.S. forces in pursuit. Now, somewhere along the way, the Bella One changed its name. The crew simply painted a new name on the hull. It became the Marinera. And it also changed flags. It lowered the flag of Guyana and used the flag of Russia.
Did that make any difference to the U.S. forces chasing it?
No, this nautical makeover did not deter the Americans. They caught up with the Marinera in the North Atlantic between Britain and Iceland, as you noted, several thousand miles from where this chase began. The U.S. forces boarded the tanker, which along with the crew is now headed to the U.S. So it's been a pretty dramatic week for the U.S. operations related to Venezuela, but many critics are still asking if there's a real plan for the road ahead. Secretary of State Marco Rubio responded and said the U.S. does have a strategy to stabilize Venezuela. One component is the U.S. taking control of up to 50 million barrels of oil from Venezuela.
We're going to sell it in the marketplace at market rates, not at the discounts Venezuela was getting. That money will then be handled in such a way that we will control how it is dispersed in a way that benefits the Venezuelan people.
So the current price of oil is relatively low, but that amount that he's talking about could work out to somewhere between $2 and $3 billion.
I'm wondering about the reaction to the U.S. seizing a tanker with a Russian flag. Has that in any way sort of increasing tensions with Moscow?
Well, the Russians certainly are not happy about this, but so far the response has been pretty measured. The Transportation Ministry says it gave this ship temporary permission to fly the Russian flag back on December 24th. It added that, quote, freedom of navigation rules operate in the open sea and no government has the right to use force against ships. Russia didn't say why it granted this permission. Perhaps it thought it might deter the U.S. from seizing the ship. Russia is an ally of Venezuela, but didn't really do anything to prevent this recent U.S. campaign. So maybe this seemed like some sort of low-cost way to assist Venezuela.
So as the Trump administration talks about its plans for Venezuela, the focus seems to be increasingly on the oil industry. So what else can you tell us about this?
Yeah, Trump gave a long interview to the New York Times last night and said U.S. oversight of Venezuela could last for years. And a lot of this focused on running the country's oil industry. It also looks like Energy Secretary Chris Wright will be playing a key role. He told an energy conference in Florida yesterday that the U.S. will be controlling the sales of Venezuela's oil industry indefinitely. So it looks like this multi-pronged approach, much of it related to the country's oil industry.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
Today, the Senate is expected to vote on a measure that could rein in the Trump administration's military actions in Venezuela. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia is one of the resolution's co-sponsors. He's a Democrat and the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on the Western Hemisphere. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Layla. Good to be with you.
Thank you for being here. What would this measure do if it were to pass?
Layla, it's a very simple measure that's part of the War Powers Resolution of 1973. It directs the president to cease the use of U.S. military in hostilities against Venezuela. And it has a specific exception where the U.S. always has the ability to defend itself from attack or imminent attack. So it would direct the president to cease military operations. It would have to be passed by the House and go to the president's desk. The president would likely veto it. But I've been down this path before. And what I found is when Congress passes a resolution like this, it's an effective message to the president that the American public is tired of war. And it's time to back off. So I want to get Congress engaged rather than have Congress hide from this as they've done for the last 4 months.
Now, the president's critics have accused him on many occasions of ignoring the will of Congress. So if this resolution passes, as you said, it would have some type of effect. But would the president just ignore it?
My experience in President Trump's first term is I did a similar resolution after the president struck and killed the Iranian military leader Soleimani in Iraq. And we did a resolution, no war in or against Iran, without congressional approval. It passed both houses. The president vetoed it, and we didn't have the votes to overturn the veto. But we noticed that the president then stepped back for the remainder of his term in terms of the aggressive military action, because he knew what it meant. When Congress votes, we don't want war, it's because their constituents don't want. I can tell you this, Virginia, a very pro-military state, Virginians don't want more wars. They want the president to focus on the cost of housing, food, energy, healthcare, childcare. They don't want more wars. And I'm hoping to get Congress to send that message loud and clear to the president.
Now, the administration has argued that this wasn't an act of war. It was a law enforcement operation, that the military was there to protect the FBI and DEA. Would the strikes and then capture of Nicolas Maduro be allowed under this resolution? I mean, would it change the actions that we saw?
They did try to make that argument in the classified hearing we had yesterday, and I can't get into the classification, but you're right, that's the argument they're making. And that argument might have a little bit of sway if all this was going in the middle of a night, executing an arrest warrant, bringing Maduro back to the Southern District of New York. But Layla, that's not what this is. We started with boat strikes against Venezuelan boats on September 2. We amassed naval assets around the country. We're seizing ships, as your last report showed. We did an invasion with 150 aircraft that bombed military sites in Venezuela. 80 Venezuelans were killed, bringing the total deaths of the, quote, enemies to about 200. American troops were injured, and now we're going to occupy and run Venezuela and seize its oil assets, the president said, likely for years. This is more than just the simple execution of an arrest warrant, and Congress shouldn't be silent about it.
And really quickly, I mean, you've put forward bills before that would limit the administration's use of force in Venezuela, and they failed because they didn't have the Republican support they needed. Would this time be any different?
I've been able to get two Republican votes on earlier ones, but like my challenge to presidential tariffs, what I've noticed is I start with a vote or two, and then I get three or four, and now I'm getting four or five. I think the Republicans are getting tired of it, the notion of endless wars. Greenland, Colombia, Cuba, Mexico, what's next? I'm hoping some will step up.
Tim Kaine, Democratic Senator of Virginia, thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Take care.
This is NPR News.
Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from National Public Radio. We bring you the news and voices of people across the nation each and every day. We are proud of the work that we do, but we want to remind you that local affiliates like KAXE bring you the voices of your friends and neighbors. From arts reporting on area voices to local and state sports or clean energy and economic development, they reflect what life is like in rural northern Minnesota. Your support is critical to the work they do, where you learn about high school students in debate, to the sacredness of water and wild rice, to the history and future of forests in the region. Being a member makes this all possible, so please go to kaxe.org.
It's 5:44. Thanks for tuning in. This is Morning Edition from National Public Radio here on People Powered, KAXE. KAXE is independent. It is supported by the community of northern Minnesota and beyond, and not part of any larger public radio organization like Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks for helping us out as we lost federal funding in 2025, and a great year-end fundraiser to make sure that voices and stories and music in northern Minnesota keep going strong, even as we enter our 50th year. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Patchy fog early today, possible freezing fog, mostly cloudy, highs 30 to 35 degrees. Southwest winds 5 to 10 becoming north, and overnight we're looking at 6 to 18 degrees above zero around the region. Coming up today, Itasca Waters continues the Practical Water Wisdom webinar series. This is free and open to all. It's at noon. You do need to register at itascawaters.org. Today, hear about traditional ecological knowledge with Shane Bowe, Water Resources Director for the Red Lake Nation, DNR. And the classic movie series continues tonight at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork with a free screening at 6:30 of Spellbound by Alfred Hitchcock.
For NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The college football semifinals kick off tonight, and the winners will advance to the championship game later this month. And incredible as it might have been for more than a century of college football, all eyes are on the University of Indiana. That's because before the season began, no school had lost more games in the history of Division I than the Hoosiers. Now, they're two wins away from their first ever national title. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is here to give us a preview. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So is this Indiana's year?
Well, certainly they have top-tier credentials. They're the only undefeated team left at this level of college football. They have amazing vibes if you watch them. You'll see quarterback Fernando Mendoza, who just won the Heisman Trophy. He also could be the number one overall pick in the NFL draft this spring. He's just like always smiling every time he's on the sideline. He's the most positive guy ever. And then they have this excellent coach in Kurt Cignetti. He's without a doubt the hottest coach in the sport right now. Yeah, they definitely have the capability to win it all. They destroyed Alabama in the quarterfinal. Yeah, they could definitely do it.
So tomorrow night they will face 5-seed Oregon. How good are they?
Yeah, I mean, there's only four teams left. They're all pretty good. The Ducks are really great. Their only loss this season was, of course, to Indiana. They are led by 20-year-old quarterback Dante Moore, who could also be a top overall pick in the NFL draft if he chooses to go. And then the other similarity there, Michelle, is that Oregon has also never won a national championship.
How about that? The fact that neither of these teams has ever won a title, but now they're both in the semifinals.
Yeah, so we got one of these teams is guaranteed to reach the championship game. And then also of note, of the other two teams, Ole Miss and Miami, both of these teams, of course, have won national titles before, but it's been a long time for Ole Miss. Their last one was back in the 1960s. And then Miami, their heyday was in the 1980s through the early 2000s, but it's been almost 25 years now since they won their last championship. So this is a semifinals. We've got no Ohio State, no Alabama, no Georgia. It's a bunch of fresh faces.
Yeah, so none of those perennial powerhouses. What do you make of that?
You know, this era of college football has changed things. Just 10 years ago, you used to have kind of more of a smaller number of teams like Alabama who could hoard all of the best players. Kids would go, they'd stay, they'd wait on the bench for their turn to play. But now because all these rules are different, you have players who can transfer to a new school each year, they're getting paid, they take the best offers and just jump ship. That has evened the playing field among power conference teams. So you have Indiana, Oregon more able to compete. This week, a reporter asked Oregon coach Dan Lanning about this exact thing, and basically he was like, look, it's chaos, yes, but teams that can handle it can climb.
We understand that college football right now is about change. There's going to be a lot of change. The teams that can do the best at adapting and handling what's thrown at you, we don't make the rules. We just have to adapt to them, and our guys handle that. They're tough kids.
So you mentioned the Ole Miss versus Miami game. Give us a quick preview there.
Yeah, well, Ole Miss is on a really cool run right now, actually. So they were coached this season by this drama magnate named Lane Kiffin, who bailed a few weeks ago for a new job at rival Louisiana State. He offered to stay to coach the team through the playoffs, but the school refused. Instead, they promoted defensive coordinator to head coach, who has since led Ole Miss through wins in the first round, a wild quarterfinal game against Georgia. But Miami, meanwhile, has also looked excellent. They upset the defending champion Ohio State on New Year's Eve. They definitely have the capability of winning this whole shebang, too. I think that one's wide open.
Okay, so Becky, a tough question for you. What's your snack during these games?
Great
popcorn
question.
Wings. Like what's the move?
Well, it depends on the setting, but you know, can't turn either of those down.
All right, that's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin,
and I'm Leila Faldig.
Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXC. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Again, that's psa@kaxc.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.
The night and day mare for some people whose houses did not burn to the ground in California a year ago.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Ascendium Education Group, which is committed to making education and training after high school a reality for learners from low-income backgrounds.
I'm David Brancaccio in Pasadena, California. 1 year after the urban firestorms here, we're focusing on a single block in Altadena. I lost my house on that street, but some days I worry it's even more complicated for my neighbors who had houses that remained standing in the smoke and soot.
But literally, I mean, these embers are like snowflakes. They're falling all around us.
I can barely face this, so I'll let CNN's Anderson Cooper do the narration.
Inside that smoke is another house.
When I first saw this in real time a year ago, I could make out in the chaos that Anderson was a half block from our place.
It is sandwiched between two houses completely ablaze. There's no way that house is going to survive.
But some did survive. On my single block, 15 houses burned up, but 10 are still there, potentially habitable, but not before knowing what and how to clean.
It feels like I have a second full-time job that I'm not being paid for and I did not ask for. I don't have the background, you know, me with a standing home.
And that's saying something because this neighbor's day job is a manager of a public health project. Ellen is also our energetic block captain, sharing info, bringing us together to eat and to commiserate. Some neighbors asked for first names only here so they could speak more freely with insurance and other financial matters in flux.
The things that I need to understand are, you know, around toxic contaminations and remediation and restoration, and I don't have a chemistry background.
Reading scientific papers, attending webinar after webinar.
I don't want to go home and worry that I'm going to end up with cancer or respiratory illness, but I ache in my heart to go home.
When we caught up in late fall, she was waiting for results from an industrial hygienist.
We know what we have tested positive for, which includes, oh my gosh, I couldn't even tell you all the things, asbestos, lead, beryllium, cyanide.
Lead, asbestos, cadmium.
Ellen's husband, Eric, is a senior engineer for NASA.
Chromium, manganese, lithium. I may be missing a heavy metal in there somewhere, but...
Who's paid for the testing that you've done so far?
Oh, we have. We've paid out of pocket our insurance company.
She says the insurance people told her no testing was necessary before professional cleaning because the soot's visible and you'll know if it's clean by eyeballing it.
The problem with that argument is that
this smoke wasn't from natural trees and brush. This smoke contains a suburb with all of its stuff and its junk.
and all those contaminants inside of them have become part of the smoke and gotten into the house.
More in a moment.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
An analysis of 6 years of wildfires in California prior to this disaster looked at which houses tend to survive and which don't. The biggest predictor, the newer the house, the better its chances. My house was 99 years old.
I am back in.
Tarika's house across the street was built a year and a half before the fires.
The house is still there. I paid out of pocket to have it clean, and then I'll fight with the insurance company later to get back what I can.
What'd you do? Did you borrow, or what'd you do?
Well, I got it out of savings, and thank God I had it, but I do want to get it back.
Some of that money went to a business model in major demand around here, post-fire remediation.
They removed the insulation, cleaned out the attic, replaced the insulation, ran machines in the house for maybe 3-4 days.
What about fabrics and clothes? Do you have to throw it out?
New couches, new carpets, new mattresses, new bedding. So
Terica, a child support officer for LA County, got back in August, 7 months after the fire. Terica's retired mom, Mary, lives with her husband, Nate, next door in a separate house that also made it through standing. The mom also ponied up the cash for decontamination. Some insurance money was promised, but since she had a loan, the bank controls the payout.
We got the money, but it went to the mortgage company, and then he's got to send in his information so we can get the money.
It's exactly as the day we left it.
Rebecca and Chris have a standing house facing Terica and Mary.
We were about to have some pizza that night before we left, and we left our plates, and I have a...
Even the hot honey still there.
Where we left it. If you were to pick it up, you would just see, you know, a circle of white inside and then soot all around it. It's a mess. It smells terrible. I know it's contaminated. I'm scared to go in without a mask.
Rebecca and Chris are both writers and actors without the background to deal with an insurance company that Chris says has canceled their fire coverage. The reason given? Because a middleman, his insurance broker, quit the business. It's not clear the cancellation is legal, but it's a living nightmare. His hopes for this new year?
Right now it's like a time capsule. It's like the same glass of water that was when we left the house is still on the counter, and I just want to clean it and to just get past the insurance process. I want to get past that.
All of our stories, including a nurse with a crucial personal finance tip as she deals with a standing house and a total loss house at the same time. Also tomorrow, rebuilding with sustainability and fire resilience in mind. My burned street. All the pieces will be streamable from marketplace.org. And in a bid to address the high cost of living, affordability is the word of the moment. President Trump says he wants to block institutional investors from buying up single-family homes. Politico's also reporting an executive order is in the works. This could have bipartisan support, depending on how it's crafted. Expect more during Trump's appearance set for the World Economic Forum in Switzerland later this month. Markets Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 2-3/10% range. The 10-year interest rate up 4.16%. In Pasadena, California, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. You're from APM, American Public Media.
We've got news headlines coming up next for you from National Public Radio. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Big thank you from me, from the staff and volunteers and board of KEXE for keeping us going in 2025 and into the future. We head into our 50th year of broadcasting of KEXE, connecting people all across northern Minnesota. Your membership dollars make that possible. Thank you so much for what you did to keep us going. We are expecting patchy fog early today with possible freezing fog. Mostly cloudy, highs 30 to 35. Southwest winds 5 to 10, becoming north with overnight temperatures from 6 to 18 degrees. Highs on Friday tomorrow, 25 to 30 degrees. News is next at 6 o'clock. I'm Heidi Holton.
Good morning. How does Minnesota...